This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Sephora stores are everywhere you are, so just pop in when you need a brown lip to match your 90s playlist, a confidence boost before your interview, or a last-minute gift for mom's birthday. There's always a Sephora near you. Just pop in. Use our store locator to find your local Sephora or Sephora at Kohl's.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope that it's successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to the Mobilities and Methods series. This series is hosted by the New Books Network in association with the Mobilities and Methods Lab at the University of Illinois at Chicago. The Mobilities and Methods Lab and New Books Network partnership provides a platform for authors, readers, and their interlocutors to engage closely with questions of mobility and movement. My name is Aliza Arıcan. Today, I'm joined by Cynthia Becker, Associate Professor in the Department of History of Art and Architecture at Boston University. We'll be talking about her book, Blackness in Morocco, Gnawa Identity Through Music and Visual Culture, published in 2020 by the University of Minnesota Press. Thank you very much, Dr. Becker, for joining us today.
Thank you for your interest in my book and asking me to participate in your series. It's a really big honor.
Of course, it's our pleasure. So at the New Books Network, we like to begin by getting to know our authors. So can you tell us about your background as an art historian and how you conceived of this book?
So I am an art historian specializing in African art, which in my field typically refers to Africa south of the Sahara. And I became interested in North Africa after I worked as a graduate student on several archaeological excavations in Tunisia at Carthage and also in Morocco. And this allowed me through experience to learn more about the arts and culture of North Africa. And this was something I hadn't really studied very much previously. You know, I studied African art history with a scholar specializing in Nigeria and Yoruba art. And North Africa is typically not covered in the curriculum. So more specifically, I excavated in 1994 at the site of Sijil Massa, which it was with an American and a Moroccan team. And Sijil Massa was a stopping point for trans-Saharan caravans during the medieval period. And one of the commodities was enslaved people. And I decided to do a dissertation project, not really on archaeology, but focusing on art of the region of southeastern Morocco where Sijil Massa was located. And this became my very first book, Amazigh Arts in Morocco, Women Shaping Berber Identity. So to do the work for this book, I lived in southeastern Morocco between 95 and 97 as a graduate student. And during this time, I attended a ceremony that involved healing and possession in a town out in the desert, outside of where Sijil Massa was located. It's located in the Tefilalet Oasis, It's in the desert in a town called Khamlia. And Khamlia was a pretty small town inhabited primarily by the descendants of enslaved people. And these were people who had aligned themselves with the local Amazigh group. The Ait Habash is the name of this group. And I was really shocked when I got there to hear that people referred to themselves as Issam Khan. So Issam Khan in Tamazirt, which is the Amazigh language spoken in that area, means slaves. And so as an American, and I grew up in New Orleans in the South, I was very sensitive to these racialized categories. And I questioned why people would adopt as their self-descriptor a word that seems to be demeaning and pejorative. And as I tried to make sense of this, people explained to me that identifying as slaves, Issam Khan, was not meant to be a pejorative term, because the term signified a link to blackness in sub-Saharan Africa, which people call the Sudan in North Africa. So when they say the Sudan, they don't mean the contemporary country of the Sudan. It's really more a general term to refer to West Africa. And so one person suggested in the Southeast that if I really wanted to learn more about blackness and the history of the trans-Saharan trade, I should really go to the city of Essaouira, which is located on the Atlantic coast on the other side of Morocco. And I should look for a man named Mahmoud Guinea. And so I had a car, it was pretty rickety. I was a grad student. I drove across the mountains and I made it to Essaouira. And at that point, 1997, it was kind of a quiet town. And I asked around, where's Mahmoud Guinea's house? People were like, okay, over there. Knocked on the door. He was home. And I was with a couple people. He agreed to play music for us that night. And I really saw a different Morocco than I had experienced living in the Southeast. And I thought this would be a great topic for a future project. And, as an Africanist art historian, then working in Morocco, the topic of Ganawa, visual culture and performance, really allowed me to address issues of African and, Middle Eastern studies, kind of bringing the two together, which previously are kind of divided. And so I was able to look at the geographic and the conceptual link between North and Sub-Saharan Africa, the division of the continent into an Arab North and a Black South, and then also work on integrating Morocco into the field of African studies, which previously it had not been. It had previously been associated with the Middle East and North Africa or the Mediterranean world. And so that's what really brought me to the topic and got me interested in it in the beginning.
Wow, this is fascinating. And I certainly am very glad that you took up this topic later on and wrote this book. You told us a little bit about the Gnawa identity and how you came to it. But my next question is on performance. So you understand Gnawa identity through practices of performance and connections to blackness. And I was wondering, what is at stake in this emphasis on performance? And what does performance tell us about blackness within and beyond the context of Morocco?
So the book certainly looks at how an understanding of blackness is connected to a Gnawa identity, and how this understanding is dependent on the performance of certain racialized signifiers. And I really tried to face this head on, how racialized categories can be a source of agency and self-respect. But at the same time, blackness in a Moroccan context is also associated with marginality and otherness, since it's linked to the history of the trans-Saharan slave trade. So the performance of blackness can reinforce certain negative stereotypes, as well as be a source of empowerment for people. So it's tricky, it's very complex. So one can ask on a larger scale whether Gnawa performances challenge dominant readings of the black body, or reinforce them. And so there's a paradox. The performance of blackness really means that one's agency is linked to the history of oppression. It's linked to the history of slavery. but it's also this very association of Blackness with alterity and otherness that Ganawa performers do that really appeal to people all across Morocco. So giving the category of Blackness a very wide appeal. And so for some people, especially in the last several decades, the act of performing and kind of appropriating a Ganawa identity, even though you may not have a history of slavery within your family, you have no ancestral connection to West Africa, people are really using Blackness as a means of social protest in a lot of ways. It's kind of an alternative, a marginal identity, and it's a way to associate yourself with the African continent, as opposed to being part of the larger Arab world, or as opposed to being Middle Eastern. And so people like it as this alternative identity. And, you know, this is a really big debate that goes beyond Morocco. As an art historian, especially, you know, I think about the work of the artist Kara Walker. And her work, she creates these life-size Black silhouettes, and she places them on white backgrounds. And her silhouettes are often scenes of racialized violence against Black bodies. And there's really a great deal of debate among people as to whether Kara Walker is reinforcing marginalization of Black people, or, you know, is she forcing us, the viewer, to reflect on the nature of such images in mainstream culture and what they mean about the history of racialized violence in the United States? And, you know, both things are happening in Kara Walker's work. And it's those kinds of things that sort of inspired me. Both things are happening in Ganawa identity and Ganawa performances.
This is fascinating. And I love hearing about how, you know, you think this together with the circulations of images, which is also very apparent in your book. So in the book, you have a chapter on postcards and photography. And through the circulations of this media, we see how, on the one hand, the Ganawa identity becomes a racialized and marketable one through the European gaze. And on the other, how the Ganawa themselves use these representations to their advantage. So how do images and their travels contribute to our understanding of these dialogical constructions of Blackness? And what does this visual lens tell us that other media might not be able to?
So I personally, as an art historian specializing in African art, have been looking at postcards for a long time. And really, it's been since the 80s that people in our field have been looking at historical postcards. And they've become a pretty serious subject of study in the field of African art history. So, you know, they're pretty fascinating as objects that circulate and as global objects. So it was really in the late 19th and early 20th century that European and some American photographers traveled to Africa. They took photographs that were then sent back to Europe, and then they were printed into postcards. And there's no copyright back then. So people were just producing things left and right, and negatives were circulating. And, you know, when these images were printed, they were often joined with captions. And the captions were written by people in Europe who knew nothing about Africa, had never traveled to the place where the images were taken. And so many of the captions are incorrect. Some of them are hand-colored, and the hand-coloring, you know, is just made up by people within Europe who are producing the postcards. And all we know is that the postcards were then sent back to Africa and then sold in shops to tourists and then also to colonial soldiers who wanted to send a souvenir home to their family. And because there was no copyright, what happened is when people saw an image was particularly marketable, they would repeat it over and over and over again. And so they really, through the study of postcards, we get a sense of the stereotypes that were recognized by people at the time, the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And they really tell us a lot about the unequal power relations that existed between Europe and Africa. And in the case of North Africa, you know, there have been a lot of studies on postcards, most of them concentrating on women and the bodies of women. showing women as, you know, the stereotype is the nude woman kind of posing in an odalisque position, sort of lying on the ground in an evocative position, showing women as being oppressed and living in harems controlled by men. And this was a European stereotype about North African women. So this would sell. And one of the things that I started to do is I started to, you know, look in archives. What are the images that I can find of Morocco? Because I started to see that there were a couple showing black men, dark-skinned men, holding instruments that I would associate with contemporary Ganawa musicians, metal cymbals. They were wearing cowrie-adorned hats, which are typical of Ganawa musicians today. They were holding the ginbri, which is a type of a plucked lute that is played by Ganawa musicians today. And I started to ask, well, what are these? Who is producing them? What can they tell us? Those kinds of things. And so there really are no archives where you can find a lot of these. So I created my own archive. I went online and I purchased them from eBay. There's a lot of sites in France that, especially because Morocco was once a French colony, where you can purchase many of these cards. And I have a collection of about 300 postcards. And one of the things that I found is that men with dark skin were always shown kind of in a very similar way, either as a soldier for the Sultan as part of his army or as a musician. And one of the things that I argue in the book is that these types of images, you know, when you pose for them, they sort of impact your own self-representation. And I say that they contributed to the formation of Ganawa as a racialized identity associated with blackness and the public performance of music at the turn of the 20th century, so late 19th, early 20th century. So I think this is really when a Ganawa identity became codified. So I use the postcards kind of in a way to sort of tell me about the process of Ganawa identity formation. And, you know, this is not to say that Ganawa music didn't exist before that, that people were not engaging in spirit possession before that date. They definitely were, because they were bringing these ideas with them from Africa south of the Sahara, and then replicating them in a North African context. But I think it's kind of this interaction that happened between black musicians and European photographers, tourists, visitors, that sort of fixated Ganawa as a identity that could be publicly performed in the public space that was associated with maleness. And, you know, of course, women are always associated with Ganawa performance, but we don't see them on these postcards. And so, you know, one of the things that I argue in the book is that I believe that it was during this period, the late 19th, early 20th century, when Morocco was becoming destabilized due to increased colonial interest within the kingdom, that the wealthy Moroccans, who were the primary slave owners, they had to manumit a lot of their slaves. And there are historical records that indicate that this was happening. They couldn't afford to keep them anymore. And so many people left for urban areas of Morocco. And so even today, Ganawa is really an urban phenomenon more than it occurs in rural areas. So the cities of Fez, Marrakesh, Essaouira, Casablanca, Tangier, I believe that enslaved people, when they were manumitted, they went to these urban centers looking for new lives, formed communities, started to perform music on the street as a way of kind of existing and living, because they don't have land to farm. They don't have large family networks. And so they created their own families and their own communities in these urban settings. So that's one of the things that postcards, when I looked at them a lot, they sort of engaged the, you know, I started thinking about these ideas more and more.
And, you know, while I really enjoyed your analysis through what can be seen on postcards, I also was struck by your careful attention to things that were not seen, which you mentioned a little bit. For example, you were in the book, you're really attuned to how Ganawa women disrupt filmmakers' voyeuristic gaze. So what can be gleaned about gender, Black representation, and agency by staying attuned to what is not captured on camera?
Yeah, so one of the things that I argue in the book is that the deliberate performance of Blackness, which is captured visually through postcards, through film, through ceremonies that are performed in public, this can really draw attention to the constructed nature of racialized categories. So in other words, if we use the postcard as an example again, when there's a postcard that's printed, it removes the image. So if you just have a person printed on a postcard, often the background is just white. And so the person is really removed from the wider world in which he or she existed. And so, for example, if we see a man performing with metal cymbals and wearing a cowrie shell hat with a white background behind him, we know nothing about the larger world in which he existed. And so this left out of account really leads to the viewer's desire to fill in the blanks, which often devolves into stereotypes and social caricatures. So studies of visual culture really recognize and emphasize the constructed nature of stereotypes. And by looking at these types of images, we hope to expose them, allowing us to view a person in a postcard, for example, not really as a victim, but really as a person who's in the process of negotiating his or her own self-representation through your choice of particular props, particular poses. And so, you know, one of the things I argue in the book a great deal is that a Ganawa identity has long been a consumable identity marketed to outsiders. I mean, Ganawa-ness is so marketed in Morocco today, but I think it's something that's been going on for a long time. And I don't view it as something necessarily negative that has been imposed upon them, but I view it as something that could be self-empowering, allowing people to engage in acts of agency. So I think often if you sort of look at what's not seen and think about what's missing from the image, it can tell you a lot about the image, but you have to be asking those types of questions and attuned to those types of things, because what is not seen is just as powerful as what is seen.
Mm-hmm. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Absolutely. This is, you know, this is really a wonderful quotable statement. So thanks for drawing our attention to what is not seen. In the book, you also vividly depict Gnawa ceremonial practices and how the Gnawa negotiate their relationship to Islam, post-slavery Morocco, and Sudan using these practices, which, you know, I think follows really well to your emphasis on, you know, representation and identity as being negotiable. So can you tell us about how these connections are forged through ceremonial practices, and how does ceremonial performance contribute to Gnawa articulations of Blackness?
So I think maybe it's best if I kind of describe a Gnawa ceremony,
mm-hmm, sure,
what it's like. So a Gnawa ceremony is called a lila, which means night in Arabic. And so Gnawa, I talked a lot about postcards, often perform in public. Mm-hmm. And when they perform in public, people kind of give them donations sometimes, because one of the things that you get is something called baraka, mm-hmm, or blessings from God, if you give money to Ganawa, because Ganawa, having a connection to blackness, is also having a connection to Bilal. So Bilal was the first muezzin, the first man to perform the Muslim call to prayer in the history of Islam. And he was a man from Eastern Africa who was enslaved and then liberated from enslavement, manumitted from enslavement by the Prophet Muhammad, and became one of the Prophet Muhammad's first followers. And so Ganawa declare that they are descendants of Bilal. And so because of this, they have healing abilities. Also, we know that many Ganawa practices are coming from Africa south of the Sahara, where you have possession by spirits being used as healing. And this occurs in so many places in Sahelian Africa. Hausa Bori is one example of that. Zar in the Sudan is another example. So people are possessed by various spirits. And when you are possessed, you're pleasing the spirit. And that causes an illness that could be induced by a spirit being angry at you to be healed, right? Mm-hmm. And you're sort of at one with the spirit. And so Ganawa ceremony then developed with the kind of these things in mind, and also being connected to Islam, because of course Morocco is a majority Muslim country, right? So the Ganawa ceremonies then are held at night, and these are private ceremonies. And so this is very different from the public performances that are captured by the postcards. And so you have to be invited to a lila, and they're typically held by a person who is suffering from an illness who has visited a diviner. And the diviner will, it's usually a woman who will tell you, you know, you have this spirit causing these problems and you need to hold the lila in order to appease the spirit. And so when you hold the lila, if you're holding it, you're the person who's ill, you hire the muqaddama, who will hire musicians, you'll buy animal, you know, to sacrifice. So you have food to feed people who've been attending the ceremony. It's kind of expensive to do. And you invite people to come over to your house. And the ceremony usually starts around 9 or 10 o'clock at night. And then it goes all night into the morning, and it can go for 12 hours, 8 hours, 24 hours. Wow. I've been to ceremonies that are 3 days. People go home and sleep in between and then come back. And so when a lila happens, the idea is that you play the music. You have the male musicians who perform the music for the spirits in a very particular order. And the order, it does vary a little bit in Morocco according to which region this particular Ganawa group is located in. But when the lila begins, the first group of spirits to be evoked are the Salahin, or the saints. And these are a group of spirits who include many historical figures associated with Islam. And when these spirits appear, people may feel touched by these spirits, like somehow have a relationship to these spirits, and they get up and they dance and they wear all white. They'll take a piece of white cloth and they put it over their heads, and they may rock in, back and forth, similar to Sufi ceremonies within Morocco, where people kind of rock back and forth and they chant the Allah, Allah, you know, or the Shahada, the Muslim profession of faith, over and over and over again. And the idea is that this will bring healing to you. Then the musicians take a break, and then they come back and they perform for the black spirits. And the black spirits that follow then are said to originate in West Africa. And one black spirit, his name is Sidi Mimoun. He's very powerful. And when he arrives, he's said to come, you know, be Sudani, meaning from the Sudan. And when he arrives, people will say, the Ganawi Hahua Jamin Sudan. You know, so it's the Ganawa. Here he comes from Sudan. So Sidi Mimoun is kind of like coming, boom, bada, boom, you know, across the Sahara, coming, coming. And the song is very powerful. And you get the sense that he's kind of fierce. And when people are possessed by Sidi Mimoun, they will get up and they dance in front of the musicians. They wear black and they hold lit candles. And they'll dance with the candles and hold them up to their skin. But the flames of the candles, you know, are touching their skin, but are not hurting them. So Sidi Mimoun is protecting them from being hurt by the flames. And there are many more spirits of different colors. So, you know, it's all in chapter four, chapter four of the book. And so I discuss pretty extensively in that chapter how people in Morocco view Ganawa ceremonies and how some people would be critical of them. Some people, some Muslims would be critical of them since they say that they're evoking spirits into possession, which is not something that is acceptable within Islam. But it's much more complex as like everything in life, right? people who go to Ganawa ceremonies and are very active, they don't see a contradiction. They don't see what they're doing as against Islam. They will perform their daily prayers. Many of them will take the pilgrimage to Mecca. You know, they fast during Ramadan. When there is the call to prayer that happens, the Ganawa ceremony stops and everyone is quiet. And then you listen to the, you know, the call to prayer that happens. And so people don't see themselves as existing in conflict with Islam or Ganawa practices as existing in conflict with Islam at all. And so, you know, but one of the things I argue in the book is that, you know, the evocation of these Sudani spirits or the black spirits, the really powerful spirits like Sidi Mimoun, that often involved dancing with fire. And some of them even involved eating raw meat and things like that, dancing with knives. I say that this was historically, I view it as a means for a, you know, marginalized people of enslaved or formerly enslaved people to, they sort of reproduce what people in Morocco might view as something exotic. Mm-hmm. And so an exotic trope. So in a way they're kind of self-exoticizing. And I think that this contributes to their otherness, but it's at the same time, it's a means of negotiating a very complex social structure that attempts to control them by really appropriating. So people are appropriating a stereotype as a means of self-empowerment because the blackness, the connection to the Sudan, the connection to Africa south of the Sahara is the source of one's power. And the closer you are with these black spirits in the Sudan, really the more spiritual potency you have. And so today in Morocco, this has become more and more important to people. And this is something that I discuss a lot in the book, especially at the last few chapters, because Ganawa identity is diffusing into the larger public and even, you know, to outsiders like me and other people. People were really emphasizing that the true Ganawa, the most powerful Ganawa are the ones who are black, the ones who have a connection to the Sudan. You know, people will tell me we're the real thing. We're the real Ganawa. Mm-hmm. You know, the other ones are not. Mm-hmm. So blackness has become even more potent and more performed than ever before.
Wow. This is really fascinating. And you do a marvelous job as showing how, you know, self-exoticization is very complex and it is a means of negotiation. And I'm also curious about contemporary forms of self-branding and self-commodification that Ganawa themselves embrace. Can you tell us about how you observed this process during your time in Essaouira? And what are the possibilities and limits of self-branding and self-commodification?
Yeah, so that, I mean, that's a great question. And I discuss it a lot in chapter five of the book. And I consider really the current marketing of Ganawa identity, which was everywhere in Essaouira, probably more so than any other city within Morocco, because this is the site of the extremely popular Ganawa Festival of World Music. Mm-hmm. And you know, this festival is so popular. There can be 40, 50,000 people who come there, and it's held every summer. It was canceled this summer. It's going to come back next summer. And I'm sure it'll be more popular than ever before. And, you know, it's a lot of foreigners, but a lot of Moroccans will come. So it's extremely popular with just Moroccans themselves, mostly. And, you know, this increased popularity of Ganawa music in the last few decades really has caused a great deal of tension between those who were, what I say, born into hereditary Ganawa families and those who recently began to play music. So within Morocco, you have people whose father were Ganawa musicians, or their mothers were diviners or something, and they perform ceremonies and healing, and they've learned the spirit possession repertoire, which is, you know, very long and detailed from their families. But there are other people who just kind of pick it up because they have friends, they're interested, maybe they have a neighbor, maybe they want to travel the world, and they see performing Ganawa music as a means that they can travel and see things and have a living for themselves and things like that. So there's a tension there between these people that's becoming more and more pronounced. And so in chapter five, I really do kind of two case studies. And one of them is about the shrine called Zawiya Sidna Bilal, which is in Essaouira. So Zawiya is a shrine, and it's really the only shrine dedicated to Bilal, who I mentioned was the muezzin of the Prophet Muhammad. And there were lots of debates when I was living in Essaouira. And I went for many, many years and lived there at one point for a year. And I often heard these debates, and people would tell me about them. I think because I was coming from outside, people would often just tell me what they wanted me to hear and their side of the story. So it became really interesting as a means of understanding how people are negotiating the commodification of Ganawa identity. And so really until about 2013, there was the shrine, the Zawiya was controlled by a family who was not a hereditary Ganawa family. And people who were hereditary Ganawa musicians were angry about that. So there was a lot of intrigue and a lot of kind of, you know, debate over who should control it. And in the end, well, the group controlling it until 2013 had formed an association. They were having Sufi ceremonies there. They were kind of viewing it as kind of a public community space. They wanted to build a museum, which they didn't finish. They had planned to put a music school there. And, you know, hereditary Ganawa musicians would say, you can't go to school to learn Ganawa music. This is something that you're born with. None of our family went to school to learn this. You know, so in the end, it was the hereditary Ganawa musicians who did take control of the shrine. And so I kind of outlined that in this chapter. And before 2013, before they had control of it, it was a really popular venue that would be packed, filled with people, you know, who would attend. They would have an annual lila that would kind of be the last lila of the year before Ramadan, because during the month of Ramadan, people say the spirits sleep. And so if you're going to have a Ganawa lila, it happens often during this month of Shaban, which is the month before the month when Ramadan happens. In Morocco, I mean, all over the Muslim world. And so it used to be really crowded, really large events. There would be TV cameras, you know, coming in, interviewing people, filming. There would be government officials. And then when you had the hereditary musicians, it became much more low key and much more like we're having it community based. This is our family. This is sacred what we're doing. So it became much more of a sacred space. Again, mm-hmm. I would say probably started off that way. Mm-hmm. And then now, due to debates between people over who had the right to control Ganawa-ness, it's returned to being a more sacred space again today. So, yeah, I kind of tell that story, which was really interesting to me. And I think the last lila that I attended there, I had, you know, it was very different. It was very quiet. No cameras allowed. People had to really pay attention, you know, and a much more different feel than when it was controlled by other people. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, that's incredible. And, you know, Blackness in Morocco read to me as a very ethnographic book. But during our conversation, I've become even more convinced that, you know, this is a very ethnographic piece of work, like the way you respond to the questions, even the way you describe how you came to write this book is very much grounded in these experiences. So I was wondering if you could tell us how you employed ethnographic methods and how you put them in conversation with art history.
Yes, I know. I guess I'm a wannabe anthropologist or ethnographer.
Anyone can be.
I have a master's degree actually in anthropology.
Oh, okay.
And a bachelor's degree in anthropology.
Okay.
Yeah. And I switched to art history. So, you know, I went to school at the University of New Orleans, and my undergraduate, and studied anthropology, and went away to graduate school at University of Wisconsin-Madison and studied anthropology, and then took a class with my graduate advisor.
Mm-hmm.
His name is Henry Jewell, and I loved his class so much and his sort of methods, which is very ethnographic. And African art history is a discipline that grew out of ethnography and anthropology. And so it's kind of from that that we have developed into a field. It's a relatively new field of study within the field of art history. I'm probably the third generation of Africanist art historians to be in academia. And so really the first generation was kind of came out of the Peace Corps. And so these were people who had lived in Africa for a very long time. And so it's brand new. And so many universities don't even offer African art history as part of the curriculum. So, so that's how I was trained. And I don't know if I can do it any other way. And I'm so interested in people. So when I meet people and I hear their stories, I just become really fascinated. I love to talk to people and learn about them and sort of how do you see the world and. And so I really tried to bring the two together, and I feel that, one of the ways is by looking at the postcards and looking at film and looking at how ethnographic films like Viviana Pak's film represents women historically and those types of things and sort of problems of representation, visual representation. And so I think all of those things, yes, they definitely have influenced my methodology. And I don't necessarily go into a project, I think, with a really clear cut, like, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. It sort of evolves when you're there. And when you meet people and you see, and Morocco is such a really wonderful place to be that, you meet one person who introduces you to another person who, and then the next thing you know, it's a whole, really fascinating thing to learn about. People are very generous in Morocco, and the hospitality is amazing. And I could not have done it without the, amazing hospitality of people inviting me to ceremonies and things. So.
That's fascinating. And I'm glad that this book came out of this multidisciplinary approach. And in the book, you also tell us that you take sounds, odors, tastes as units of analysis. Could you speak to this sensorial approach? How did it enrich your understanding of Gnawa identity?
So, one of the things that if you go to a Lila in Morocco, one of the things that you will notice is the smell of incense, Jawi, is really strong, right? And every time I smell it today, I think of being in a Lila. And sometimes I even kind of crave the smell of Jawi, of incense, because I've become so used to it and I love it so much. And it just evokes so many really wonderful memories. So, scholars have discussed how the sense of smell and the sense of taste are so memorial to people, mnemonic devices that remind them of place. And I think certain smells are equated in a Gnawa Lila with sub-Saharan Africa. So certain smells are, said to bring you into, into the Sudan. And there are certain foods that are created for the spirits. And at the very end of a Lila, there is a certain food that is dispersed, that is cooked, especially for the spirits. And I was actually never allowed to eat it by people because they said, you're coming in from outside. What if you couldn't make it one year, from the US, and then you might get sick because the spirits are going to crave this food.
Mm.
And so they advised me against eating it, which I did. I didn't eat it, but it was good advice. It's true, Especially with COVID, I didn't go back for a while. So, you know, there, so it's definitely sounds, odors, taste, as you say, foods that take you to a certain place. And I think remind us even of Sudaniness and blackness in a Ganawa context that are just as important as seeing, you know, the visual, because all of those things are activated during a ceremony. You have the clanking sound of the iron cymbal. You have the plucking of the ginbri along with sort of frapping the skin of the ginbri, like a frame drum, you know, and all of those things with the smell of the incense. I mean, you can't get a spirit to possess you unless you have all of those things going. And then once the spirits arrive, they do require people to eat certain foods that the spirits prefer. And so if you don't have all of those things working in conjunction, you don't have a successful spirit possession and you don't have a successful healing that takes place. So you really need all of those things to work together. And so I tried to make that come out as much as I could within the book.
I think you did a fabulous job with it. And I'm sure your book will be of interest to our listeners who might be working on sensory ethnographies.
Thank you.
Before we end, I want to ask you, what is next for you? What are some new projects, pieces of writing, or even classes you're working on right now?
So thanks for asking. you know, because of COVID, I thought that I wouldn't be able to go back to Morocco for a while. Hopefully I can go sooner rather than later. But I started a project in my hometown because of it. So I'm originally from New Orleans. I do live in Boston. I teach at Boston University. But I'm from New Orleans. And so I started a project that I had worked on previously looking at the Confederate monuments. And so this project is called, at this point, Beyond Marble and Bronze, Commemorating Women's Lives in Post-Reconstruction New Orleans. And so I'm looking at how economically and socially marginalized women in New Orleans created monuments or memorials to express their experiences and to confront unequal power dynamics conveyed by the monuments dedicated to the Confederacy. So I kind of became interested in this because, you know, there was a lot of discussion about the Confederate monuments coming down in New Orleans, and New Orleans is one of the cities that took down several of them many years ago. That was very controversial. And so, now, I found that everyone's talking about these monuments, but what are the sort of forms of visual culture, the forms of performing arts that have been created by people to confront the monuments, you know, over the last 100 years? You know, people are not just looking at these monuments and not reacting to them and not doing anything in response to them. And so I'm looking at things like Black Indian performances as a response to Jim Crow laws and things like that in New Orleans, Marie Laveau and altars dedicated to her and practices associated with her. She was a Creole woman who was associated with the practice of voodoo and healing. So things like that. And so I hope I have a sabbatical in the spring and I hope to write a book on this topic during my sabbatical, so during the spring of 2022. And you can see that some of the issues sort of overlap with the project on Ganawa identity in Morocco. And then hopefully after that, I'm back in Morocco doing something new.
Hopefully. Well, we'll certainly be looking forward to this new project. It sounds wonderful. And with that being said, thank you very much, Dr. Becker, for joining us and for your insights.
Thank you very much. It's been really wonderful speaking with you.
It's my pleasure. I'm your host, Aliza Ercan. This discussion of Blackness in Morocco, Gnawa Identity Through Music and Visual Culture, published by the University of Minnesota Press in 2020, is brought to you by the New Books Network in association with the Mobilities and Methods Lab at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Thank you for listening.